Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Writer's Lounge, show number 66, and I am your host, Tom Riddell, and tonight, very special show, first time ever we've done it in the 2.5 years we've been on the air. It's a talk with the authors, Hugh Howey, Michael Sullivan, and Brian D. Anderson, and it's a show that you're not going to want to miss. If you can, get on over to the Blog Talk Radio site, go into the chat room over there, and of course, if you'd want to make phone calls, I'll give you the number in just a second. So I'm very excited about tonight's show, but let's get on to the other part of the show where we explain a little bit about what we are and who we are. And this is the show, of course, where we showcase new authors, and I am your host once again, Tom Riddell. We normally have a co-host, guest co-host, Lisa Lee, and she's going to be monitoring the chat room tonight. So I thank Lisa for that. A brief intro to today's show. As we said, Michael Sullivan, Hugh Howey, and Brian D. Anderson will be here to discuss their books and their writing techniques and styles. And hopefully they'll have some advice for you struggling writers out there, so you might too also become an author one day. You can find us over at the Writer's Lounge blog over at tomriddell.com/blog. Up in the upper left-hand corner, you'll find the Blog Talk Radio player, and you can go and click on each one of those little buttons there that you see, and you will be able to listen to all the reviews or all the shows of all the reviews of the books that I did on that site. Of course, you can go over to Facebook and look for us there. Of course, I won't even tell you how to do it. You know it, the Writer's Lounge. Just type it in and you go there. The Twitter, of course, you can follow us over there. We're on Twitter. And the old-fashioned way, of course, TWL11 at yahoo.com if you'd like to shoot us an email. And we always appreciate that. Upcoming guest authors in 2 weeks, we are going to have Dave Moore on, and he wrote Lines in the Wall. So we're really looking forward to that. It's a true story. Once again, we're kind of moving away a little bit of the fiction here, going into nonfiction. So that will be an interesting little segment here that you're not going to want to miss either. Sponsoring our show tonight, as always, Magic Pen Web Design offers its clients a simple, effective, and affordable approach to website design development. You can go over and fill out the free estimate form over at magicpenwebdesign.com and let Magic Pen help you to sell that next book with a website design that works its magic for you. And, of course, let's once again tell everybody out there that's listening, I do see that there's a number of people in our chat room. Hello to everybody there. And if you would like to call us, I'd ask for you to hold off on your phone calls for around 35 minutes after the hour. We're going to be taking calls for about 10 minutes. But if you feel the need that you really need to call in, we'll try to field a couple of calls, but we don't want to light up the switchboard too much. So just take your time there and get into the chat room and be as patient as you possibly can as we talk to Hugh, Michael, and Brian. And, okay, on with the show. And let's get on to our first. Of course, I'm sorry, I've got to announce the phone numbers if you want to call. Something I almost forgot to do to tell the authors who are on today. I had to send an email, so they had to get the numbers. So here's the numbers for you guys out there if you'd like to call later on. It's 626-213-5613 or toll-free at 877-878-1436. Now I'd like to introduce the first author here. In high school, he, like many kids, played soccer, and he was also on a chessboard a lot, and he made an attempt to write his first novel several times. In his adult years, he has sailed south and began a career as a yacht captain, which took him to many amazing places. And now, of course, he's an author of several books, and I'm going to let him tell you about his books. And his name is Hugh Howey. And hopefully, we've got the right number for Hugh. We will punch the magic button and bring on Hugh. And Hugh, are you there?
I might be. Oh,
there you go, Hugh. Is this Hugh?
It is. How's it going?
Oh, I'm doing very good. How about yourself?
Doing great, man. Thanks for having me on your show.
Very good. Where are you calling from?
I live in Jupiter, Florida.
Oh, very nice weather down there. Up here we've got tornadoes, severe thunderstorm warnings, and tomorrow we're going to get back to the icky, snowy stuff. So how do you like that for weather?
Yeah, we save it up down here. We have great weather until a hurricane hits, and then we get it all at once.
Very good. Very good. So, Hugh, why don't you tell us, first of all, how did you become interested in being a writer? And tell us also a little bit about the books that you've got out there for sale.
Well, I guess like most people, I got interested in writing from being an avid reader. When I was a kid, I always had a book in my hands, would read under the dinner table, would get in trouble with teachers in class for reading when I was supposed to be paying attention to their coursework. So I was just addicted to books. And I think when you're, when you live in other people's worlds and enjoy escaping like that a lot, it just fires up your imagination. You start thinking of the stories that you would tell if you're able to. And so I tried when I was younger writing and gave up on it. Felt like it was something that required some superhuman effort, and it wasn't until 20 years of futility that I finally had the dedication and the time in my life to sit and finish a manuscript, and I've been hooked on writing ever since.
Very good. And a little bit about your sailing activities. Can you tell us a little bit about where you went and how you got involved in doing that?
Yeah, it started while I was in college. I bought an inexpensive sailboat to live on while I was in school at the College of Charleston. And a friend of mine and I went up to Baltimore and picked it up in January and sailed it down off the coast and nearly got ourselves killed a few times. It was a horrific journey, and I swear I would never go to sea again. But I got more comfortable sailing around Charleston Harbor and ended up, after my junior year, I took a leave of absence and sailed down to the Bahamas for a year and went, had a great time island hopping, went through a couple of hurricanes and started working on other people's boats. And that led to a career as a yacht captain, driving, you know, luxury yachts all over the Caribbean and up and down the East Coast. And a lot of my reading time came during that period of my life, but also the time sitting at the helm daydreaming and thinking up stories. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to draw on those experiences when I started writing.
You know, all those amazing exotic places that you've been and all those amazing people you met along the way, those people that were on your ships and, you know, the excitement that goes along with it obviously fueled your imagination and gave you the tools to start that writing career and probably a lot more confidence than you had when you attempted to write that novel in high school that you kind of put down, myself included, tried doing that and didn't have much success. So, yeah, that's quite a story, Hugh. I'm really impressed with everything that you've done. I really have not, and I have to admit, I really have not gone out there and read any of your books. I would like to, and here's your chance to sell me and everybody out there on what you've written. Can you tell us a little bit about the books that you've written?
Yeah, but I'm horrible at selling my books to people. If you ask me to recommend a book, I'll always recommend somebody else's, and I've got a pile of books that I would recommend over mine. I write all over the place. I've written young adult books, horror books, regular fiction, some literary works, science fiction, dystopia. My latest release, Sand, is almost verges on fantasy. It's science fiction in the loosest of senses. So, yeah, I don't really know how to classify my works, and I'm just horrible at convincing people to. I think it's up to readers and booksellers and librarians and people like that to recommend books to people. I think I've had a lot more enjoyment connecting with the people who've already read my works. So I tend to invest my time that way. But
cool.
I just think some people are more comfortable doing that, and I'm not.
Right, right. I'm just wondering if I've got my sidekick here, and she's monitoring the chat room. I'm wondering, do we have any questions for Hugh at this time?
Yes. How old are you, and are you single?
I'm 38, and I'm not single. So I'm probably too old to be desirable, and I'm not available anyway.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
You must not have any pictures of me up there.
Yeah. No, we've got a picture up on our Facebook site. Very good-looking chap, I might say myself. Yeah. okay, so what do you think is the key to your success in the books that you've written? I know there's many ingredients there, but what are the main keys to doing what you've done?
Well, most people might, I guess, define my success with the number of books I've sold and the fact that I write full-time and movie deals and things like that, but I tend not to look at it that way. I felt extremely successful when I completed my first manuscript and had a book that was solid and could be read beginning to end and was, fit for consumption. And that... I think that's what we should aim for as writers, to write a book that we're proud of and that we would put out there beside any other book and not be embarrassed if someone picked it up and gave it a read. And every book I release, I feel that same pressure to produce something that I'm going to be proud of years later. And, how the book does and all the sales, so much of that's luck. And I've been very fortunate to have published when I did, when ebooks were taking off and self-publishing was taking off. But I think the best things you can do to prepare yourself for writing great books is to read a lot and read a wide variety of material. Don't just stick to your genre, but really expand your reading taste, because you'll learn something from every book. And to live a lot, to take on as many life adventures as possible. And there's always something you can do. I mean, I would spend my spring breaks at university volunteering in soup kitchens, and that, like, I would get to stay in a convent in the Bronx and work and live in a very dangerous community and meet people that I would never meet in my normal routine, and that gives me something that I can write about with authenticity. And every weekend, every hour of your free time, there's some adventure you can go put yourself on, some new place to go to, some way of making yourself uncomfortable. And I think that's a necessity for writing stories that people will care about. So I think I prepared myself unwittingly to be a decent writer by reading a lot and by saying yes to any adventure that came my way.
Very good. And the last question, first of all, I want to let everybody know once again, this is a two-hour show, and we're going to have a roundtable after we introduce the three authors here, where they're going to all be able to sit around and discuss the writing techniques and everything that goes into what they're doing to be a success. So once again, if you want to get in here, I'd ask for you to hold on to your phone calls until 35 minutes after the hour, then you can come on and give us a call here at 626-213-5613 or toll-free at 877-878-1436. And, Hugh, before we let you go and introduce Mr. Sullivan, I'd like to ask you, where do you see the future of publishing going here?
I think the trends that have taken place in the last few years will continue. We may have seen a large part of the transition take place already, but I don't see these trends stopping. I don't think we've reached an equilibrium. The costs of production and distribution have gone to zero, and that's revolutionizing every entertainment field. You know, you look at the move from analog to digital and what it's done to the camera industry, what it's doing to music. You know, we don't have video rental stores anymore. We don't have music stores in our shopping malls. So if people think that these changes are not going to affect storytelling, I just can't imagine how it wouldn't. And I think more and more people are going to get comfortable with stories being words, and those words can be delivered in a lot of different ways, and they're all pretty much, you know, equivalent. I think we'll see print on demand gain more of a place in the market. I think we'll see print on demand become returnable, and that will allow bookstores to take a chance on more writers. And so there's still a lot of change to be made, but basically what's happening is the reader and the writer are becoming more and more empowered. They're more and more in charge of this industry, and that's, you know, terrifying for the people who have facilitated the exchange of story between writer and reader. And I know there's a lot being done to try to slow the pace of change down, but I don't think there's any stopping it. It's just too easy to once you have a great story, it's too easy to deliver it to people who have the demand there. And, you know, anybody getting in the way of that, I think, is going to be bypassed, and that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, very well said. Hugh, I'm going to put you on hold here. We'll bring you back when we discuss a few things with Michael and Brian. We'll bring you back for the roundtable, and we'll have you back in just a little bit, so hang on there.
Sounds great.
Okay, and next up, when he was 8 years old, he sat down at a manual typewriter and typed out, "It was a dark and stormy night," and a shot rang out. And after studying the greats like Stephen King, he wrote 10 novels, but could not get them published. And he quit. But now he's back. And coming back here is Mr. Michael Sullivan. And Michael, how are you doing?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Wonderful.
Okay. You're a little fuzzy there. I don't know if are you talking on a cell phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I think we're going to hear you just fine. If you maybe speak up a little bit more with volume, I think we'll do great. But
okay.
Michael, I'm pleased, I'm happy, I'm excited to get all of you three guys together. And you've all got some wonderful stories. And like I say, I have not read any of your books, and I intend to as long as I can finish the backlog of books that I'm doing for the other authors on this show. But could you tell us a little bit about how you became interested in being a writer?
Well, I actually started when unlike Hugh, I actually hated reading. I despised reading. I was 13 years old before I read my first book, and it was an old boy and his dog story, which, as far as I'm concerned, was incredibly boring. And I struggled an entire summer just to get through that book. So that was my first experience, and I just didn't have any interest in reading. But then I happened to stumble on the Tolkien's The Hobbit, which I picked up. And I ended up spending, I think, 3 months reading through the entire Lord of the Rings, and I just loved it. And so I went, all right, well, now I know what I want to do. So I went out to the bookstore to find another one, but this was way back in early 70s, and they didn't have, you know, Tolkien clones at that time. They had virtually nothing similar at all. And that left me really kind of depressed because I had just discovered that reading could be fun, But unfortunately, I discovered that there wasn't any other things to read at the time, at least nothing that I was interested in. I would pick up books and try reading them, and just they were not the same. So eventually, I thought, well, what if I just wrote my own? So I think I was around 13 years old, and I just started writing novels. I actually wrote about three novels when I was in high school, which was bizarre. Everyone thought it was strange. I mean, most kids didn't do that. So that was really what I wanted to get into. It was just because I wanted to write books that I wanted to read.
Yeah, and you kind of, your forte is creating worlds. Is that correct? More of the place than the character is more of your interest?
No, not really. I tend to be more of a character-centered writer. I like building characters mostly. The world is just very convenient because if you create your own world, you have a lot more control over what can happen and what can't happen and what is going to be considered to be wrong or what's going to be considered to be right. See, originally I wrote in every genre that in existence, I think, except for romance was the only one I didn't write in. But the first book that actually got published was my fantasy series, and the only reason I think that was successful is merely because it was at the point that, as you had mentioned, I had given up. I had written for 20 years, and I just gave up because I wasn't getting anywhere. And that's when I was trying to write the great American novel. I was trying to write what I thought was great and what was good, and I just gave up on that. And it wasn't until I said, I just want to read, that I wrote a fantasy novel for the fun of it, and that's what actually got published.
Right. And then, of course, you went on to become a best-selling author in the indie field, and I'm wondering, what do you think is the key to your success, as I asked Hugh earlier?
Well, again, it had a lot to do with timing because, yeah, I hit on 2010 when the Kindle and all the other e-books took off. But also there was, the help of bloggers and the sites like Goodreads where they just, embraced me there and were able to spread the word. And also I think having to do with the fact that if you write a book, I mean, there's a question about what makes a good book, what makes a bad book, and to me that's relative. But I think what makes a good book sell is making something that appeals to a large audience. And apparently I've managed to do that, and I think to some degree totally by accident. But it seemed to have worked out in this round.
Right, right. And we're going to discuss a lot more of this during our roundtable. And once again, if you want to get into the chat room, I see a lot of chatters in there, but I don't see too much. They're kind of shy. I think they're just listening to the show more than likely. They're probably not in the chat room, but we do have a chat room. Once again, we're opened up there. So if you want to get in and throw a question out to these authors, we'd love to have you. And of course, if you want to give us a call, you can do that later on. We ask you to co-hold off in probably another 10 minutes or so after I talk with Brian. We'll let you come in at 626-213-5613 and toll free at 877-878-1436. And Michael, the last question before we get on to Brian, where do you see the future of publishing going?
Well, I'd like to think that publishing is going to improve due to the fact that more authors have more say, and hopefully that would give them more strength in negotiating contracts, and hopefully that would improve things such as, percentage of ebook royalties and more control. But unfortunately, I think in the realm of writing, there are so many authors who are so eager to be published that I'm not certain that is really going to make that big of a change. It's sort of like, back in the 30s when they were trying to deal with businesses and you couldn't really, because there was always more people who were willing to work for less. And there's a lot of authors who want to be published so much that they'll just continue to accept the situation as it is. And that's kind of depressing. I would like to see that change, but I'm not sure that it actually will.
Yep.
And, of course, there's a concern about whether bookstores will eventually become, not viable anymore. And I'm always wondering about what happens then, because one of the biggest advantages of going through a traditional publisher is the fact that, they can get you in bookstores. But if bookstores aren't there, then their added value is drastically reduced. So I don't know.
Yeah, That kind of bothers me a little bit. I love walking through a bookstore. I hope to God it never goes away. I hope that it isn't all going to be e-books. I hope they still are around with the prints. I really would miss that terribly, and I think it would be a detriment to society if that were to happen. Real quick, I watched a movie last night called The Book Thief, and I learned a lot from that movie about reading and writing and how much value a book actually has the old-fashioned way when you pick one up and leaf through the pages. Looks like we do have a question, and Lisa's got the question for you.
Yep. Autumn would like to know, how quickly do you write? So how long does it usually take you to write a book? Which was a great question.
How long does it take me to write a novel?
Yep.
Okay. So, it tends to vary. On average, it takes me about 2 to 3 months to write a novel. However, the very first two that I wrote, I did in 1 month each. But
Wow. That
was when I was literally writing and doing nothing else. I woke up, I wrote, I ate, I wrote, I slept, I got up and did it again. And that was when I did it just constantly.
Yeah, yeah.
Nowadays, I like to have a life.
Yeah, it's the itch that all of us writers have. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to do that because I'm so involved in doing the show and reading and reviewing books. So I haven't really had a chance to get back to my novel, but we'll discuss that later. Michael, I'm going to put you on hold, and we're going to go right to Brian here, and we'll bring you back for the roundtable.
Okay.
Okay, and next up, his 8-year-old son, Jonathan, came home one day with an idea for a book. So Brian, who has always had a love for fantasy, decided to write Jonathan's story, and now, just a few years later, he finds himself in a whirlwind of fans. And it's very exciting for him, I know, because he's told me this, to be among both Hugh and Michael. And we'd like to bring him on the show again, one of our old-timers here on the Writer's Lounge, one of our great supporters, Mr. Brian D. Anderson. And Brian, welcome to the Writer's Lounge once again, my friend.
Hey, Tom. How you doing, buddy?
Doing really well, Brian, doing really well. Waiting for the tornadoes to leave so the snow can come in. Yeah, you know, you guys that are down in, I think, Hugh lives in Florida along with you.
He's a little more southern Florida than I am. I'm over in just outside of Pensacola. So
yeah.
It still gets chilly at night.
Yeah.
But I got to say, it's a thrill to be on the show with these two guys. And, you know, all modesty aside for, you know, on their part, these guys have done, you know, so much, and Hugh and Michael both have they're just incredible, incredible writers. I've read their work, and they are something else for real.
Yeah, we're looking forward to the roundtable here in a few minutes, Brian. But tell everybody, how did you become interested in being a writer?
Well, you know, it's funny. I, much like Michael, discovered Lord of the Rings, and I'd always loved reading, but I really fell in love with fantasy when I read The Lord of the Rings before I read The Hobbit, actually. And right then, I wanted to be a writer right then, right? So I sit down, and I write this, you know, little manuscript. I couldn't have been more than, like, 12, 13 years old. And I bring it to my uncle. And, oh, my God, I was just certain that I was brilliant, you know, that I was going to be the first 13-year-old to, you know, to do what I was doing. Of course, you know, he started laughing and kind of hurt my feelings, but, and I didn't write again for a very long time. And, you know, before that, I'd always written essays and short stories and stuff like that, but it wasn't until my son came to me with this idea that I decided to really take writing seriously, because the story was so compelling. And, you know, I'd worked on some other things, real, you know, dark sort of cerebral type stuff. But, you know, and I tried to write fantasy before, but never could really get it right. And as soon as I started writing my son's story, it just sort of clicked. And that's kind of the way it began for me. And then the popularity of it began to build way beyond anything I expected, and just sort of took off from there, man.
Yeah, I love to tell the story. I think I probably tell it every time that you're on, Brian, but Brian and I have become fairly close friends, and every now and then Brian will call me up on the phone and support me and my struggles in my life that I've been going through in the last month or so and even longer back. But I know that one time I got a phone call from him around midnight and woke me up, and he apologized immediately. And I said, no, go ahead and tell me what's going on. He says, Tom, you won't believe it. They've just sold 50 to 100 copies in India. And so, you know, getting a phone call at midnight, you know, for some people would be immediate hang up. But I was so excited I had to get out of bed and pump my fist for him, because he's been a big supporter of this program. And we'd love to have him on here, and he's really been a success. In fact, the first two installments of his books sold 50,000 readers bought copies of his first two installments of the Godling Chronicles within the first 3 months of their release. So once again, as an indie author, that's amazing. And Brian, the next question would be, of course, this is a loaded one that we've discussed before, and I know Michael and Hugh have also inputted on this, but what do you think is the key to your success?
Just persistence. I'll tell you one thing I've noticed about both Hugh and Michael is that they're still working, not just at writing, but at going out there to the public. They respond to their fans. They're out there doing book signing, doing promotion. You know, they're still all pushing, you know, pushing forward. You know, they're not just because they sold millions of copies doesn't mean they stop. And I think that's I think that's a real key to success. That, you know, you sell a few books, you know, that doesn't mean it's over. That means it's just beginning. And that's one thing that's impressed me about them, and one thing I've always tried to do. I'm always out there trying to still promoting, still pushing forward, and, you know, never giving up and just being relentless. And I think that if I had to say anything was a key to success, I would say it's not just a key to success in writing, but pretty much any endeavor.
Absolutely. And the last question we have here before we get on to the questions from chatters and phone calls, possibly, or if not, then I have a few questions of my own for you guys. But where do you see the future of publishing going?
You know, with the ease of self-publishing, and, you know, and I don't think traditional publishing is going anywhere, but I think it's going to change. I think a lot of authors that I read an article not long ago in The Guardian, and it said something to the effect that some of the literary novelists who are writing literary fiction, you know, award-winning novelists are having a hard time. They're not making as much. Their signing bonuses there aren't as much. And my question I kept coming up to was, well, why don't you certainly have a backlog of stuff, you know, if you're making less money, why don't you start self-publishing along with your traditional publishing? And I think what you're going to see is some traditional self-published people like myself. Well, I'm with small press and self-published, and yeah, they're going to continue on the way they're continuing, but I think you're going to see a lot of the traditional published authors doing a lot of combination of both. I think you're going to see almost a melding from the author standpoint.
So you don't see bookstores disappearing anytime soon, right?
I don't see all of them. We have one in Fairhope, Alabama called the Page and Palette that has been around since I was a kid. They're still going strong. But they're going strong because they get authors like Reardon's been there, Winston Groom's been there. I mean, you name it. They get these authors in there for signings, and they're also in the right type of community. Fairhope is a very artsy, you know, art-driven community. And, you know, maybe I think the big bookstores, it's going to be kind of a turnaround. You're going to see the mom-and-pop bookstores doing much better because, you know, they have to have less overhead. But they're going to have to go out and bring authors in and almost, you know, make it do events and things like that. But, I think that's what you're going to see. That's my opinion on that.
Mm-hmm. Good. Lisa, it looks like Lisa's got a question for you from a chatter.
No.
Oh, you don't?
Well, for the roundtable.
Oh, for the round table, okay. Okay. Oh, okay. So Hugh is going to be leaving us at 9:30 his time, which would be another hour. But we should be well into the round table by then, so that's fine. We're going to bring on all of our authors back onto the show here. And once again, if you want to give us a call, you can do that at 626-213-5613 or 877-878-1436. That's the toll-free number if you would like to chat with these guys. And now we have all three back on, and I would like to once again thank you, gentlemen, for the brief introductions that we did on the show, and welcome to the Writers' Lounge Roundtable. But before we get into discussing that, I do have a question. I think probably let's put this one out to Hugh. He might have a handle on this, but I'm wondering, Hugh, of how many indie authors are making a living, an actual living from the books that they write, aside from you guys? I know all three of you are full-time authors, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
I think so. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have any idea, any numbers on how many indie authors are actually out there making a living?
Nobody knows that number. I wish we did. I wish, and Michael's an even bigger data geek than I am, so I know he would agree with that. But I wish we had complete transparency on these sorts of things, but we don't. What I suspect from my time in the trenches and spending way too much time reading every article on publishing and reading the comments and just getting a feel for what's going on and going to conferences. I spend half of my year on the road meeting with writers and publishing professionals. And the sense that I've had in the trenches for the last 3 years is that more people are earning a living with fiction writing as self-published authors today than are earning a living as traditionally published authors. The hybrids, and I really hate that term, but the people who do both seem to be doing the best, but that's when you talk to them, most of their income comes from their self-publishing pursuits. So my answer is I don't know, but it's more than we're making a living writing 10 years ago, because
right.
Getting rid of the middleman has left a lot more for the author and has allowed lower prices while still earning more per sale, and that's worked great for readers and writers.
Cool. Brian and Michael, do you have any input on that question?
Yeah, I'd have to pretty much agree with you. As they basically said exactly what I would have said, that everyone that I've met, I know several independently published people as well as traditionally published, and almost a vast majority of the traditional publishers are having a situation where they're just living on their advances. And the average advance for a book is somewhere around, if you're doing well, it's like $10,000. So if you make a three-book deal, you're making $30,000, and then you have 3 years to write those books. So it's not really something you can live on. It's something that can be supplemental. But if
sure.
you're self-publishing, then you have a situation where you put, I mean, you're probably not going to live off of a book or two that way either. But if you get three or four books out there and they're doing reasonably well, you can sell less books and make more money. And that is what makes it more lucrative for someone who is what would be considered a middle or mid-level writer. It works better that way. But if you're phenomenally successful, I don't know if self-publishing is best, but I think for just about anything lower than that, you're probably going to be far, far more well off, I think, on a financial standpoint if you're self-publishing.
Sure. Yeah, Brian, anything?
Yeah, you know what? I saw a list one time of about, that was well over 200 to 300, somewhere around in that writers, and that was just a list of people that one from one source. So I think, you know, I think if the real numbers were out there, it would be staggering how many people are actually making a living. And also, I think it has, you know, what is how much money do you need to live? Like with a self-published, your own, like the $10,000 advance that Michael mentioned just a second ago. You know, if you put out a book at $3.99 and you sell, say, I think you hit $10,000 at selling 4,000 books off of Amazon, just Amazon. So I think the numbers, if the real numbers were out there, I think it would blow most people away. I really believe that.
Yeah, guys, I was just wondering about, you talking about Amazon there, Brian. I was wondering what's the cut that Amazon would take from a sale? Do you know what the percentage is?
30? Yeah, it's like, it depends on the pricing. Anybody else have a little bit better idea of that?
What's the cut that Amazon takes? It's about 30%, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, they think it's 30%, but there's a little bit of delivery cost, and if you're selling in other territories, there can be VAT taxes that take off of that. And if you're pricing below $2.99 or above $99, it drops down. They take 65% and leave you 35%. So it's a little convoluted, but in general, if you price your book in the right place, it all averages out to about 65% is what you keep, in my experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's about right.
Yeah, and along with that, I was just wondering too. I read somewhere where you do much better. For instance, I'm sure you all have series, but I was reading where an author that wants to get out there and maybe make a living off from this art would do better if they started a series instead of just writing one single book and trying to get it sold. For instance, if somebody's writing a memoir such as I have, I heard that it's much more lucrative. And I think Brian could answer that one. My experience with him is that, you know, once you start following the Godling Chronicles, you can't stop. It's like eating... It's like eating potato chips. You just got to have another one.
I think all of us, all three of us, are series writers. You know, mine developed into a 6-book series when it was meant to be a trilogy, and that came out because of printing costs through CreateSpace. Originally, I was printing through CreateSpace, and that, you know, you get to a 600-700-page book, it's like a $30 book, and unless the meaning of life is in the pages, nobody's going to buy that from an unknown author. But I know Michael and Q does. Yeah, I think Archer's divided up into serials, right? You know, all your stuff are kind of like serials. The most recent Wool and Sand, right?
I've done that with a couple of books where I've released them in installments. I've got, two different series and 5 or 6 standalones. So you know, I know that a lot of people are doing well, have series, and it's because people end up buying the books all the way across them. But I also know from watching the sales of my first series that if I had not broken out and written other stuff, I would not have done as well. I think it's easy for writers to get trapped into just writing sequels. And if that first book doesn't take off, you know, when you're writing book 4, you're still relying on people to pick up book 1. So you don't have something new to lure in new readers. You just, are trying to hope that your existing readers will follow along. And if the first book you ever write is what you're banking on people getting into your work with, then as you grow as a writer, you're still introducing them to your very first attempt to write a novel. So I lean toward writing a lot of different things. Yeah, I mean,
I agree with that.
I would recommend writing a lot of different stuff.
Yeah, I know my, me and Michael do strictly fantasy at this, well, not strictly, but are known for that. And I think fantasy, Michael, would you agree that fantasy lends itself to series work?
Well, it certainly has in the recent past. I think a lot of people who read fantasy have a tendency to expect there to be series. I'm not quite so sure that is as prevalent in the world of science fiction. I'm sure there are, but I mean, it's not quite as consistent. I mean, because back in the 60s and when it became popular, I mean, Tolkien had this, like, mandate where he made a series, and therefore, like, everyone felt that it had to be not only just a series but a trilogy for so long. that was the, you know, the touchstone that everyone had to mimic. But now it's changing up a bit, and I tend to think that if you want to be successful at it, it's not necessarily a situation where you need to write a series, but you do have to have more than one book out there. I think you have three or four books out there. If they're similar or if they're related in some way, that's good, because they like the first one, they'll go to the next one. But like you were saying, true, if you don't like the first one, then what? So having more than one book out there is going to be the key to getting really, you know, financially successful.
Now, how many books before Orbit noticed you?
I thought that was directed to me.
I happen to know that Michael's series is published through Orbit.
I actually produced the first five books in a six-book series, and as I was just publishing the fifth book, that's when Orbit, I got in touch with Orbit through an agent.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah, and they reproduced them in a series of three omnibuses after that point, and they wanted me to wait on the last book so they could be the one who actually released the final book of the series.
Oh, Nino. Well, and you got like a killer print deal, right? You just got back from Europe doing all that?
No, I didn't go to Europe.
No, Hugh Howey, didn't you go to Europe? You just got back from like Italy and places like that with pushing your print deal, right, with Simon Schuster?
No, the Simon Schuster deal was in the U.S. We've got deals with 31 different publishers around the world. So my most recent trip was in Taiwan. But yeah, I spent 2 months in Europe last year. I spent more than half my year last year on the road, and this year is shaping up to be about the same.
Well, that's where those $2 billion checks come from.
I just saw the
Hades hater, the best hater I've ever seen in my life. I'm telling you, Tom.
The guy made
a 20-minute hate video about Hugh Howey. It was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. We'll have to direct people to that. Once again, I liked everybody. Oh, it looks like we got somebody right away. And I just was going, oh, now they went away. So I guess they're shy. Whoever that was that called, go ahead and call again, 626-213-5613, or toll-free at 877-878-1436. And I'd like to ask you guys, I guess any one of you, well, let's go down the list here, Hugh, Michael, and Brian, but I'd like to ask you about cover art. How important is cover art in selling an e-book, not just a print book, but an e-book?
I think it's hugely important, and I think you have to have new things to consider from the print days. You really need the book to stand out as a thumbnail, and you need the books to have a very common theme, because people scroll through lists and lists of books, and they need to the theme of your book needs to jump out at them, that so that they see several impressions of your name or of the cover design. But you know, when I look at designs, I shrink them down to, you know, the size of what you'll see browsing lists on Amazon. And does the font jump out, and does the cover art look good at that size? That's a key consideration.
Yeah, cool. Hey, we do have a caller here. I've never seen we have letters coming up here. I don't really know if I want to even say what the letters are. But we do have a person on the phone here, and we'll bring him on the Writer's Lounge. And you're on with Tom Rydell, I'm the host, and, of course, Hugh Howey, Michael Sullivan, and Brian D. Anderson. What's your question or comment?
Oh, my name is Amencita Wright. I'm actually in the chat room. I didn't call in for anything. I was the one that asked about the outlining. So, yeah.
Okay. I mean, we got you on the phone now. There must be something that you're wondering about to ask one of these three amazing writers here.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I'm a beginning writer, and I'm going through the blues of writing and throwing it away, writing and throwing it away. And what I've learned is that for new writers, the suggestion is that we should outline. I'm writing a nonfiction book, and it says that, you know, we should outline. And when we outline, we should write everything out because, you know, this is the way that we'll learn it. And it actually works out for me, but sometimes I get tired of the writing and I want to put everything on the Word document. But I found out another way a writer suggested to me and said about the sticky pads and a board and taking the sticky pad and the board and, like, outlining everything that way.
Any ideas, guys?
That's certainly one way to do it. I don't think there's one secret sauce to writing. Everyone has to experiment and try different methods. The one thing that won't work is not sitting down and doing the writing. And I think the people who make it spend hours every single day, even with full-time jobs and kids and other things. You cut out TV, you cut out video games, you cut out something in your life, and you spend that time every single day working on your book and pushing it forward, even if it's just a few sentences. If you do that every day, you will write a novel.
Just really quick, I love the writing. I don't mind the writing. I'm talking about when it comes to the outlining. I feel like I spend so much time on the outlining, it's taking away my writing. And another thing, too, I also blog. And I actually took time away from that because I felt that was taken away from time in the book as well. So I'm just in a place where I'm learning how to balance myself and just put everything together as one. But the main thing with me now is really learning how to outline and use different techniques to really get that done.
Well, it's going to be different depending on nonfiction versus fiction, but there's kind of, I consider there's three different ways of doing it. You're going to do a heavy outline where you do it very detailed and then you write through, or you don't outline at all and you just write, see what happens. And then when you get done, you generally have a really good idea of what you're going to do and then you rewrite it again. And the third is somewhere in between where you kind of have a very light outline where you have just the headers, like probably what you're talking about with the sticky notes, or some people use index cards. And you just kind of move things around. Once you have all the topics you want to have covered, you move them around and figure out what the best order would be. And then you go through and use that as a guide to kind of then expand as you write. But it's really going to be what you're trying to find out what kind of method works for you.
Yes, basically that's what I'm doing. But I'm finding that the outline helps out a great deal because it really gives you a vision of everything. It's like you're canvassing, you're painting a picture, and it's like it gives you that image. So I'm really enjoying the outlining part of it.
Cool. Thank you, caller, for being on the show, and thank you for not being shy. I appreciate it, and we'll send you back to the chat room. Guys, once again, it's great to have callers call in, and we'd like to have more callers. We have people in the chat room sitting there. We have a lot of people listening to the show, so once again, you can listen to the archives of this show, obviously, too. So that'll be a big benefit of our show. And we were talking about cover art. I'm not sure. I think Hugh had an input there. Michael, was it you or Hugh that I was talking to about cover art?
I think you were talking to Hugh a minute ago.
Okay.
I'll give you my 2 cents on that if you care. I was going to say that everyone judges a book by its cover. So, yeah, it's incredibly important for a decent cover. Generally speaking, when you see them, you can tell, most often you can kind of tell what is self-published and what is traditionally published, because a lot of people who self-publish feel that they can also do the cover themselves, and while they may be a great writer, they might not be such a good designer or illustrator. And I have a feeling that most people will look at the cover and be immediately turned off by something that looks subpar. And so it really is important if you're really serious about self-publishing, it's incredibly important to both get a good editor to go over your work and to have someone do a decent cover art and layout for the book. Other than that, you're just going to perpetuate the problem that most people see as being, you know, inadequate effort being put into a self-published novel, which people are expecting to find anyway because there's still a great deal of stigma out there. So you end up having to do twice as much work in order to be given half the credit.
Yeah, and I know that Brian has had a lot of experience and some really wonderful cover art for his books. And I'd like to know, Brian, when you how do you go shopping for a cover artist? I mean, what's the process? Yeah. I know you've had a lot of good luck.
Well, you know what? I agree with both Hugh and Michael on this. When I first when book one of my series, I self-published it through a vanity press, and the cover was okay, but it didn't jump out at you. And the moment I signed with a small publisher and we changed the cover, the moment the cover changed, that's when it started selling, you know, and it really, it is the ball game right there. You know what I mean? I went from there, I went through a couple of different, you know, cover ideas, and, you know, I finally got a guy, a real great cover artist, named Michael Gauss, who did my latest cover, and he's going to be doing my next one as well. It makes all the difference in the world, you know, and it does show the reader that, you know, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of investigation to figure out that somebody's either with a small press or self-published or something like that, but when they see that you've taken the time and done a really good cover and done it well, they'll give you a chance. You know, they see that you care about your work. And, you know, I think as writers, especially with self-published writers, the people who are out there supporting indie work, we owe it to them to do the best we can if we don't have the money for a good editor, save up. That's what I did. I saved my money. And I worked odd jobs. I collected anything I could do to make the money to get it done. And I think we owe it to them with our cover art, with our editing, with the whole process to justify the support they've been giving us and continue to give us.
Hmm. Yeah, it really means a lot. And once again, you can judge a book by its cover. I think that stands out is number one when you're shopping around to get your book sold. You could have a wonderful novel written, but if the cover doesn't match up to the novel, then I think you're going to fall short. I know a lot of authors out there who have run into that kind of a problem trying to do their own cover art or trying to get somebody to do it for them, and they just don't have the money to spend to have the artist do the covers for them. The next subject that I have, sort of a question here is, how do you guys feel about, I know that when a lot of authors put out their first ebook up there on either Kindle or any number of those e-readers, they kind of struggle with whether or not they want to charge or they want to put out a free ebook. Some people say you're selling yourself short by giving away your material for free. I was wondering how you guys felt about that, starting at the top with Hugh.
I see nothing wrong with giving works away. I don't think it devalues literature at all. I think what devalues literature is to have it not being read. And, you know, numerous times I've lent books to friends and they've read them, enjoyed them without paying a penny for them. And if I go to someone's house and I see a book on their shelf that I want to read, I will ask if I can borrow it. And I've been going to libraries, you know, my whole life, and I just bought a bunch of books from a used bookstore, and a lot of these transactions, like a used bookstore, leaves the author and the publisher out of the transaction. But if you ask most authors who find out that I bought their book at a used bookstore and I'm reading it, enjoying it, they'll tell you that they're thrilled to have a reader, to have someone finishing their work, someone who will recommend it if they enjoy it or seek out their other works. So I don't buy into the idea that free or low prices devalues literature. I think that's just not a concern of mine, and I can't imagine why it would be a concern that others would have.
Michael?
I know that a lot of people can use that for promotions, and it does work. I mean, I have a number of short stories that I put out for free for the purpose of giving people the ability to sample my work before, you know, buying a book. But I do think there could be a potential problem there, because if you create an environment where people expect to get everything for free, which has kind of happened somewhat in the music industry, you have a population where they just feel that paying for something is not something that they should be bothered doing. And if you do that, you get into a situation where writers who are struggling to get going end up having no means of getting an income. And I don't really think that a person should have a problem with spending, you know, a couple bucks on a book or as much, you know, certainly more than a pack of gum, which some people have been pricing their books at. So I would like to see books, you know, be reasonably compensated for, because I don't want to have, you know, writers not being able to make a living. And I mean, it certainly works much better when you have, and people like what writers do, and writers can do so much more if they also don't have to have a day job or two day jobs as well as writing. And that's kind of what I would like to see happen. And I don't want to see it get to a point where people just expect, well, I can just get all my reading for free, so why should I ever pay for it? In which case you have people who can never get a job or can never maintain a writing lifestyle where they can continue to put out and improve.
Yep. Okay, Brian, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I think that a lot of writers, they put their stuff out there for free with the hopes of getting readers. Now, and it sounds great. And I don't have a problem if somebody wants to do that. They can do that. It's their decision. That's what, you know, being independent means. That means you get to make that decision. But the fact of the matter is, most people who download these free books, they go through the book thing, unless it's an author they know, and they go, oh, I can get his book for free. They'll go through the free list and just download book after book after book, and they're not really getting readers. They'll just sit there in the Kindle for or the Nook or the whatever their device is forever and ever, and eventually they'll either delete it and just never get around to it because they got 1,000 books in there that they just downloaded because it was free. Now, and it also, and I noticed in some, you know, there's some like, well, should I make my book 99 cents? There's nothing wrong with that either. The problem is I have seen several independent writers who had traditionally released their books at 99 cents, and then they started releasing them at $3.99, and nobody wanted to buy them because they were so accustomed to that writer, you know, being a 99-cent book guy. So that's kind of where I stand on that.
Well, okay, everybody, once again, if you're into the Blog Talk Radio site and you're listening to the show, I just want to remind you, you can go into the chat room. Don't be afraid. Go on in there, and we have our assistant here, my co-host, Lisa, is monitoring. We do have questions. Yes, okay, we're going to breathe and go ahead, get close to the mic here, Lisa, and go ahead with the question.
All right, guys, one of the questions that has been asked is, do you have any tips on both the craft and also on publishing, getting a publisher?
Okay, let's go with Hugh.
Well, for craft, I think you have to write a book that you're thrilled to engage with every day. If you're not excited to get up and or at the end of your workday, sit down and push your story forward, if you're not consumed thinking about your characters and your plot all day long, then you need to maybe move the story in a different direction, because it has to be as compelling to you as it will be to readers. And for publishing, I mean, there are a lot of different opinions on this, and I probably have a minority opinion, but it's one that I've had for years and much longer than I've had any success. I don't think that we should be courting publishers. I personally don't court publishers. I court readers, and I put out my best works, and I have said, and this was well before anyone ever came to me, any publisher agent came to me, I said that there'll be a day where we put our stories out there, and if enough readers like them, then publishers and agents will come to us, and we'll hire who we want. We won't just take the first agent that'll give us the time of day. We won't take the first publisher that offers us money. We'll have we'll be the one doing the hiring, and we'll have our choice. And I had that attitude going into it, and it worked out for me, and I was able to write without any stress about being marketable or writing what I thought would be commercial. I wrote what I was interested in, and let everything else come after. You know, my goal is to focus on the reader, and that starts with writing a story that my wife and my mom will enjoy, and everything seems to fall into place after that.
Boy, if there's a quote that you can put the quote marks around and push up there onto, you know, book sites and reader sites and writer sites, it would be what you said would be, but now let's just run over my head, and I forgot what you said. I didn't forget what you said.
It's very memorable.
You want to court, yes, you want to court the readers, not the publishers. I think that is key, I think, in getting yourself out there. It's the readers that you want, not so much the publishers. And I think a lot of writers, a lot of authors may fall into that other category where they're going after the wrong people. So, Michael, what do you think about what Hugh said and anything you can add?
I think he's right on about the idea of writing a book that you want to read. I think that's, like I said, that's what turned everything around for me, was when I gave up trying to write what I thought others would want to read and end up writing what I wanted to give myself. In fact, I went so far as to try to, you know, I didn't like what I was finding on bookshelves, and I wanted to prove to myself that I could write what I wanted to see that I wasn't finding. And that gave me kind of this challenge, which I found very exciting, the idea of could I make a book, you know, or was it too hard? You know, why aren't they out there? So just making something that I really wanted to actually find and read my, you know, actually I enjoyed reading it myself. That was part of the fun of it. And when you really enjoy what you're doing, I think it comes through. If you're not enjoying what you're doing or you're floundering around, I think then you have more problem with that. Also, another thing that I find very good to do is once you've written your first draft, when you get through with that, to put it down for a while and not look at it for maybe a couple months at least. And then when you come back to it, sit down and read it not where you would write it, but where you would normally read any other book. Like if you read in bed or in a couch or someplace, read it there as if it were a real book. And when you go through it, you'll read it as a reader, not as a writer. And when you do that, you'll find bigger problems with the book than you might find otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Brian, what do you have to say?
You know, both those guys I couldn't have said that better. You know, I learned to write by reading authors that I love. And I could never write like Tolkien. I think about my love for reading his books, and when I write, I think about my readers. Are they gonna enjoy this? You know, because I know there's some writers out there that want to consider themselves artists, and some truly are. You know, I consider myself more of an entertainer, and if it entertained me. And I think it will entertain my readers, and you know that's who I'm trying to reach. I agree with you on not writing for a publisher or an agent or whatever you're out there to get. Write for your readers. You know that's who, and because that is who we're after. And with today's with the ability we have now to go direct to the reader, you can do that. You know, I mean. If you want to be published, and I think the biggest bargaining chip you could ever have is already be a success and already be reaching the readers. You know, I mean, I, unless I'm completely mistaken, both Hugh and Michael attained publishing deals through them. They came to them, unless I'm – am I wrong, fellas? They came to you guys, right?
Actually, my wife had an agent actually approach Orbit. I don't know what.
Oh, okay. But you were already very well known, you know.
Yeah, I was selling fine. I mean, I was debated not taking the contract just because of the fact that I knew I would actually make less money if I signed with a traditional publisher, least in the initial run. It turned out that I didn't. It turned out it worked out just fine. But I had the suspicion that I was actually going to lose money on the deal.
So, I know what you were, you know, ebooks, all everything, and you know, they came to you for your print deal, correct?
Yeah, I had an agent. I had agents approach me and turned down a few, and found one I really liked, and then she wanted to take the work overseas and to Hollywood and to. Domestic publishers, and we went through three rounds of offers from publishers, and we just were saying no to most of them because they wanted the digital rights, and I went into it not wanting to sign a deal and not expecting to, but we got the sort of deal that we really couldn't say no to. We hoped it would be something that would break barriers and result in more deals like this for just the print rights. So that's one of the reasons that we went with the deal that we took.
Let me. I actually have a question because I just recently released my series in audiobook, and I know you guys have it as well. And I actually messaged Michael about this earlier today. What's y'all's experience with the audiobook so far? Where do you think that's going? Do you think that's going to be a big part of what's going to be happening in the future?
I actually think that audiobooks are today kind of like what e-books were about 3 or 4 years ago. It's just taking off. I was at the Audis this last summer, I think it was, one of my books were up for it, and they had a presentation that I watched, and they were talking about how they were just a few years ago, they were doing the major award-winning books in people's closets. That's how new the audio book is taking off now, because before they would only do it for select books, but they just recently opened it up to genre. And so this is a really kind of a new offering. And I was amazed because I noticed that my author rating jumped on Amazon. I couldn't figure out for the long life. I mean, why
that
was.
Yeah, mine too. I did the same thing.
Yeah, and then I started getting these, they were running a promotion where they would give you $1 for every book you sold. And suddenly I'm getting these checks. I'm like, where is this coming from? And I finally tracked it down and discovered that I was like on the top, I forget what it was, top 10 or top 100 on audio books. And I'm like, wow, here I didn't even think that the right was going to be worth even trying to fight for. And here, yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I was just wondering, Lisa, I'm sure we have some other questions we want to get to from the chat room.
Yep. Is it wiser to self-publish all of them or go hybrid and query out the standalones?
Well, let's start with Brian. Let's start with Brian this time, Brian.
I don't know if you're going to want to start with me on this one, man. Compared to these other two guys, I'm pretty small time. I haven't written a standalone book up to now, Book one of my series was the first full-length novel I'd ever written. So,
okay.
I think I might want to feel that one to the other two.
Yeah, let's go with Michael.
Well, funny to say that because I just wrote, it's a year ago that I wrote a standalone book, which is now going to be self-published. It's actually a print-only deal with Tachyon, but it's going to be the e-book I'll be retaining. But that's kind of my foray back into self-publishing. I don't really think it really matters whether it's a standalone or a series. I think for me, getting traditionally published was important because it opened doors for people to notice me more. It expanded my fan base dramatically. But now that I've already done that, now that I've basically got that pedigree, I can now become more of a hybrid author because now when I'm self-publishing, people won't say, a lot of the stigma is gone, which really helps. But overall, I think hybriding is probably the best way to go for both getting self-control as well as financial reasons. But I don't think it really matters whether you're doing it with a series or standalone.
Hugh, what do you think?
I think it's up to each writer and what they want out of their career and what they, if they want to see their book in bookstores, they should probably query some books. I'm an outlier in my attitude towards this. I don't recommend people to take my advice, but my personal attitude is just to write for the readers, and I really don't care if I sign deals with publishers, and I've turned down seven-figure deals with publishers because they didn't feel right to me, and I worried about how the book would be priced for the readers and what it would do to my writing routine. So I probably wouldn't listen to my advice on this, but my personal opinion is not to query anything and just write for the readers and not, Brian sells himself short comparing himself to Michael and I think anyone who's writing a work to completion and getting it out there and having people read it and love it and sending a piece of fan mail or writing a review on Amazon and saying how much they love the work, everyone who's doing that, who's writing every day and finishing their works and getting them out there and finding readers, they're all equal in my opinion. I think some of us are lucky to make a living off of it, and that's incredible, but that's not why I got into it, and I'd be perfectly happy going back to working in a bookstore and writing in my spare time and having family and friends tell me they love my stories. That's that anybody who's doing that to me is winning in my book.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Once again, you're listening to the Writer's Lounge. I'm your host, Tom Riddell, and if you'd like to talk to Michael Sullivan, Hugh Howey, and Brian D. Anderson, give us a call at 626-213-5613 or toll-free at 877-878-1436. And we had one caller, but we have a lot of people in the chat room. And Lisa, do we have another one?
Yes. Autumn asks, Kindle Select, good idea or bad idea?
Let's go with Brian on that one.
Yeah, you know what? I think Kindle Select. I think Kindle Select's a good idea. At first, for the first because it does allow you to be in the book lending pool, and it allows you a couple of promotional tools. I think you got to be careful with it though. I think if you have a bunch of work out, it's probably a bad idea because you don't want to be stuck with just being able to publish on Amazon with a release. But I think when you first, if it's your first novel, I think it's a good idea.
Well, Michael?
Yeah, I'm probably going to agree with him mostly. I don't like the fact that it makes it exclusive and you can't, sell it over various, vendors. I would not be as interested in that.
And Hugh?
I think it's good for starting out. Personally, I still like Kindle Select. I mean, my latest release is a Kindle Select book, and I love the extra exposure it gets. And most of my I tend to focus on Amazon anyway, and it's fine for me if the other outlets are delayed a little bit because so few readers discover me through those outlets. And there are, the iBook store at Kobo, those people have reached out and tried to help merchandise and support some independent writers, but there are other outlets that don't seem to care too much, and I really want to focus where I feel like I have support from readers and the people involved in the publishing of the books.
Mm-hmm.
How many books should you, what should you cap it at?
What do you mean? How many?
How many books should you stay with the Kindle Select?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's every writer is going to have to figure that out for themselves. I would be fine taking all of my books and putting them all in the Kindle Select and being exclusive to that. And I'd also be fine with starting my career with publishing everywhere all at once and never using Kindle Select. There's really no easy formula. A lot of people think the Kindle Select has lost its marketing value from where it was a year and a half ago when it debuted. So that's something to consider as well.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, actually, I have a question for you guys. Y'all are and it's kind of maybe a little controversial question, and but I'm sure you're aware of Anne Rice's petition regarding bullying. Do y'all have an opinion on that?
No, I'm not aware of that one.
Oh, you're not? Oh,
no.
Hugh, are you aware of it?
I saw something about it, but it happened while I was on tour, and I have not followed it closely. I imagine it has something to do with, it sounds like it's an extension of what was going on at Goodreads with people feeling like writers were behaving poorly, and then the people who were trying to get them in line were behaving poorly, and, you know, it sounds like internet stuff.
I think it started like that. I think, like, some writers like Cassandra Clare or something, they had received some, like, threats, and they were trying to, what they were trying to do is get everybody who posts reviews to have to leave their real name.
Yeah, I'm uncomfortable with that. I mean, I prefer not to be anonymous online because I think it does make us behave better, but I think there are cases where anonymity might be necessary. If you're critiquing a political book, if you live in a country where you can't review a book, you know, there's...
You're a school teacher that likes erotica and wants to review it.
Exactly. There's a lot of cases where I would think people want to protect their privacy. And I don't think you're going to end... You're not going to make people behave well, and I think you have to do that through being a good example. We're not going to be able to legislate or petition people into not being jerks online.
Yeah, I don't think two wrongs makes a right, you know what I mean? Make two wrong, it'd be like two wrongs trying to make a right, you know?
Yeah, I think the people involved, their hearts were in the right place. I just don't know if it can work like they really want it to work.
In regards to that, what Brian had pointed out regarding reviews, I'm just wondering what you guys feel. It's more of probably a question of advice for first-time authors. How would you advise a writer or author to how do they deal with a bad review? Let's start with Hugh on this one.
Oh my gosh, I'm the worst person to ask this. I've undergone a bit of a transformation. I agonized over my bad reviews, and you know, I don't mind bad reviews that say my writing is horrible, but because I tend to agree with those. But I've had bad reviews that. But, you know, I had a comparison in Entertainment Weekly to 50 Shades of Grey, and immediately two reviews pop up that say you shouldn't read this because of all the gratuitous sex in a book that has absolutely no sex in it. And what bothers me about those reviews is people are going to read those and assume the book has sex in it and either buy it hoping for it or not buy it because they don't want it. But obviously, you know, but these two reviews were which came out the day that Entertainment Weekly hit the stands with that story, were just designed to hurt sales, whether it's because they're other writers or they're just griefers or they're people who don't like 50 Shades of Grey and they're out to vanquish pornography in all its myriad forms. Whatever the reason, it just really, I couldn't believe that people would go out of their way to write a disingenuous review to try to hurt someone's writing career. And, you know, eventually got to the point that I... now that I know there's a lot of that happening online, it bothers me less, maybe just because I'm getting inured to it. But maybe it's sad that I'm getting used to that. But that,
Hugh,
I don't mind bad reviews as long as they're honest.
Hugh, I think you're very humble, and a question has popped in my head that I have to ask you. We're not going to look at just one of your books, but if you were to take all your books and you were going to rate them 1 star to 5 stars, where would you be on the star scale?
I would put most of my books around 3 stars. I think they're above average. You know, 2.5 stars would be average, and I think most of my books are above average.
I would
agree with them. They're definitely above average.
Yeah, I understand Brian Anderson went on and pumped up a bunch of 5 stars in some of his books. Is that true, Brian?
Oh, man. First of all, I will know that I've hit the big time when I have somebody get online and make a 20-minute hate video about how bad I suck. But that has not happened. I mean, I hear authors getting death threats. I can't even get anybody to threaten to beat me up. But, we all get bad reviews. It's part of it. You know, I mean, oh my God. You know, I mean, what always confuses me is that I'll get a terrible review on, say, 2 books, and then a 3rd book, same person reviewing it all through the series. I'm like, did you think I was going to get any better? You know. Please, for the love of God, stop reading my work.
I want to make sure I get in everybody here on that question. I'm not sure if I got Michael in here, but we do have another we have another caller here online, and I want to bring them on. But I understand that Hugh, you got about what, another 5 minutes you can spend with us.
Yeah, and then you guys will you won't have to be subjected to my answers anymore.
Okay. All right. Let's go with the caller. Caller, you're from area code 718. You're on the Writer's Lounge with host Tom Riddell and Hugh Howey, Michael Sullivan, and Brian D. Anderson. What's your question or comment?
Okay, this is Aminty again. I was thinking about having, when you have a blog site, is that blog site the best way to build your reader audience before completing your book? And while you're building that audience, should you keep mentioning the book, or should you just hold on to even mentioning it until it's complete?
Q?
I think it's good to have a blog just to start developing content, but no one will be reading it, and it takes a long time to develop a readership through a blog, but you might as well have it. I don't think you're going to drive a lot of sales to your blog. Usually it works the other way around, where people come to your blog once you have some success, and it's a great way for readers to find you after they finish your work. But I don't think you can build up a career through blogging. I'm sure there are exceptions to that, but I think it would be very difficult to do that.
Michael.
Well, what about Facebook?
Go ahead. Michael, what do you think?
I want to listen to what Michael has to say. I'm sorry. That was rude.
That's okay. I was going to say that, he's absolutely right. If you make a blog site, really no one's ever going to read it, not for a long time. If you want to build up a readership, the best way to do that is really to go to sites like Goodreads and Facebook and so on and so forth and become part of communities, particularly like on Goodreads where there are readers. And you share your views on books and they learn about you. And then when eventually your book does come out, you'll be able to, you'll be able to promote it a little bit because people will know who you are. Because people don't trust writers who come out and say, read my book or buy my book. They don't like that at all. But if they know you, if you're a friend of theirs that they know on a community site, then when they find out that you wrote a book, they'll go, oh, yeah, this is great. Let me see your book. And then you'll start building a reputation that way. But you really don't want to be pushing your book that way. And as far as your blog is concerned, sure, put it up on your blog. Sure, write about your book. Because that's why people will be going to your blog, is to find out about you as an author and your book. But, yeah, initially I don't think a lot of people are going to be going there.
Cool. And Brian?
Yeah, I agree with both of them. You know, I mean, it's I just restarted a new blog, so I'm kind of starting over from scratch with my blog. But, honestly, your blog is what people are going to find after they've read your stuff. And, yeah, you don't want to be a spammer, just like Michael said. You don't want to go on these chat sites and say, hey, read my book, because they're just going to ignore you and you're going to, throw away any chance you had of getting readers. But I also tell people, stay away from, don't try to promote your book on writers of chat rooms, because, especially indie writers, because they're after the same audience that you are. You want to go where the readers are, not where the writers are. there's far more readers than there are writers, and if they do like you, if you become friends with them, the word of mouth in the literary community is tremendous.
Very good. Caller, you got one more quick question or comment?
Well, I just want to thank you guys so much.
Okay, I'm sorry. Hugh, you got to take off.
Yeah, I got to jump off. I'm going to jump on Skype for another thing. Thank you so much for having me on, and I thank you, Michael and Brian, too, for teaching me so much. So thank you, guys.
It's great. And
I'm
going to
appreciate it.
I'm going to have to review your book there, Hugh, and see if I can get you above a 3.5 star.
Good luck.
Okay. Hey, take care there, buddy. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Bye.
And there he goes. I just cut him off. Hugh Howey. He's a great author. I hope you all take a chance and go for his books, and I'm sure you'll probably find that he's better than a 3.5 star, because he sold a lot and he's doing really well in his career. Caller, what other comment or question you have for Brian and Michael?
Well, just real quick to the authors, I completely took myself off of Facebook. I felt it was becoming a distraction. So my key now is I was to elevate my writing and really take it much more serious and really learn how to build an audience. So that's my biggest goal right now, and that's what I'm working on, and making sure I go to the correct site to make that happen.
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world, my dear.
Yeah, and hopefully, like I said, if you got on something like probably more Goodreads would be probably where you're going to get more of your readers than Facebook. Facebook is all, you know, about anything, really, whereas Goodreads is more focused on readers. And if you get something, and there'll be little groups in there that may have something to do with your book, and you can get into those and start making friends with individuals who are going to be readily buying it when you get it ready.
Very good. Caller,
hey, Michael,
thank
I got a question
you.
For you, man. I got a question for you.
Yeah.
No, for Michael, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I just let the caller go, but thank you, caller, for coming on, and thank you for not being shy. We do have, I think, some more questions. We have one in the chat room for Brian and Michael.
In a series, when you're writing a series of books, when do you get out?
How do you end the series of books? What's your thought on that, Brian?
How do I end it? Oh my God, I'm writing the last one of the Goblin Chronicles right now, and it is the most torturous, agonizing, horrible thing I've ever tried to do. it's the climax of how my career began. So it's like, you know. How do you end it?
You say goodbye. I imagine it hurts to say goodbye to all those characters. You're sort of putting them on a shelf, and they're screaming to live, and you just sort of taped their mouths up. So I would imagine it's very difficult. Would you agree? Would you agree, Michael?
Well, I'm kind of strange in this. I don't think anyone else does this, perhaps, but myself. But when I write a series, I actually write the entire series front to end before I publish. It's really one big story to me that I've just kind of broken down into episodes. So each book has a beginning, middle, and end. But for me, I'm really writing a really long story. So I know when I start where it's going to end. I'm pretty sure exactly how I know how that's going to work out. Now, there may be twists that change as I go through it. But when I started, I know pretty much where it's going. So I don't really suffer from that problem. In fact, right now I'm writing a three-book series, and no one has read it, not even my wife. And I'm getting into the last few chapters of the last book, but no one gets to see it until I've gone through the whole thing, because I want to be able to go back and edit, you know, the beginning, middle, and end if I have to make it all break sense. So it's really one big story, so I don't really have that issue.
Wow.
Yeah. Hey, I got a question for you, Michael. I've read the entire series, and I still don't know how to pronounce it.
Okay. So it's rye as in the bread, as in the body part, and ah as in oh. That's how
Rhaera.
You pronounce
okay.
Rhaera.
Well, I did the same thing with a lot of Tolkien stuff. I read the Lord of the Rings three times, and I was like, oh, it's that name again, so I'm just making it what it sounded like in my head. You know?
Well, there's a lot of cases where people will actually just identify with the image. You don't actually hear the word. They just see it, and they know what it is, but they never actually know how to pronounce it. They just and so in many cases, when I create a word, like a name, I'll actually be just as important to me how it looks on a page as to how it would sound.
Where do you come up with your names? I mean, I know we're fantasy writers, and we have to come up with some pretty oddball names sometimes. Do you have a source, or you just, brainstorm it?
I keep a list. I actually, steal names from everywhere. I'll keep a pencil and pad in the car. A great source is street names. So there's three streets near my house. One's called Niblick, another one's called Mashy, and I forget the third one, but I thought they'd be great names for goblins. And it turns out someone wrote back to me and said, those are names for golf clubs.
Wow. I go to that little name site where like I'll use ancient Hindu and Sanskrit and like change it up a little bit.
Yeah, no, I will just make them up off the top of my head. Also, if you happen to use Scrivener, it has a name generator based on ethnic backgrounds and first and last name. So that's always a great source. And then, of course, the Internet, you just type in names for anybody, and you just pick out the good ones and you make a list out of them.
Oh, wow.
That's good. Hey, guys, I do have something here that I want to play for you. It's something in regards to It's in regards to a book in the novel, and I think it has something to do with where is it going in the future. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with these two individuals. I'm going to play the first clip first, and it's from a Paul Auster, A-U-S-T-E-R, on the book novel. It's about 3 minutes long. It'll give us a little bit of a break, and then we'll be back on the show with your comments. Here we go.
Philip has been talking like this for decades now, and the fact is he keeps writing books and people keep reading them, and I disagree strenuously. Human beings need stories, and we're looking for them in all kinds of places, whether it's television, whether it's comic books or movies or radio plays, whatever form. People are hungry for stories. Children, I mean, think of your own childhood, how important the bedtime story was, how important these imaginary experiences were for you. They help shape reality, and I think human beings wouldn't be human without narrative fiction. Okay, perhaps, the market, the way things are moving, fewer people are reading novels than previously. But still, if you walk into a bookstore, there are thousands upon thousands of them there. And they wouldn't be in print unless somebody was buying them. Libraries are crammed with novels as well. And people are reading them. And I don't think it's ever going to dry up because, two, the novel is such a flexible form. It's not like a sonnet. It's not fixed. You can do anything you want with it. It's just a story that you tell within the covers of a book. But all bets are off. There are no rules. And that's why I think the novel is constantly reinventing itself. And society continues to reinvent itself. Every historical moment needs the stories to be told about it. So, much as I admire Philip Roth, I just think he's wrong about this. Well, I know it's changing already, or at least there are new things that have been happening, but it even goes back 10, 20 years now. Hypertext, Bob Coover doing all these things with computers and multiple narrators of stories, multiple authors of stories, I should say. I don't know. I'm not a man deeply interested in technology. It eludes me. I confess I don't even have a computer. I don't have a cell phone. But I did read recently about a new digital magazine doing very short stories that people can read on their telephones. Maybe this is interesting. Maybe not. I think people are trying out ideas with the new technology, and it's too early to say where it's going exactly. But
that's Paul Auster on the book novel. It was several years ago. I found it very interesting, and I want to preface that with a comment from Phil Roth. It's about 2 minutes long, and this is what he had to say about the book novel.
You said, I saw that in an interview, that you don't think novels are going to be read 25 years from now. Were you being provocative, or do you believe that to be true?
I was being optimistic about 25 years, really. Mm. No, I think it's going to be cultic. I think there are always people who will be reading them, but there will be a small group of people, maybe more people than now read Latin poetry, but somewhere in that range. Mm. You know?
Is there anything you think that novelists can do about that, or is just that you think the narrative form is just going to die out? It's just the length of them, or what? Is that what's dictating you to writing shorter books now?
It's the print that's the problem. It's the book. It's the object itself. To read a novel requires a certain kind of concentration, focus, devotion to the reading. If you read a novel in more than 2 weeks, you don't read the novel, really. So I think that that kind of concentration and focus and attentiveness is hard to come by. It's hard to find huge numbers of people or large numbers of people to get those numbers of people who have those qualities.
Do you feel that the Kindle is not going to be that? I mean, when I'm on airplanes now, I now see people reading Kindles all the time.
I don't think the Kindle will make any difference to what I'm talking about, which is that the book can't compete with the screen. It couldn't compete beginning with the movie screen, it couldn't compete with the television screen, and it can't compete with the computer screen. And now we have all those screens. So against all those screens, that's the book and measure on their own.
Okay, that's a very interesting topic, and it did bring me to a question that I had. I think I could wrap it all up into one question here. This one I would like to put to both of you guys. First to Brian, is reading a dying activity, as some people think? As Phil
Absolutely
Roth?
Absolutely not. Okay. No. If anything, it's growing. It's changing, you know, and the ideas of serial works and things like that, audiobooks and things like that is adding to it. I don't think it is not dying. I mean, if it was dying, how is it so many people do so well as authors?
That's true. And Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, I actually remember that the publishers were doing very badly. I think it was in the 80s and 90s as they consolidated. But then Kindle came out and J.K. Rowling pretty much proved that false. I mean, she turned out an entire generation to reading again, and it became, I mean, I would think they're selling far more books these days than they have been for quite some time. So if anything, it's probably on the uprising rather than going down. It's far more versatile. You can do much more with it. You can read it in any place you want to. Movies and things require technology. If you don't have the technology, you have some problem there.
Right. Yeah, listening to that made me cringe, made me afraid that they might be right. I don't believe they are, but I don't have the figures to know if people are reading more or less than they used to as far as the novel's concerned, maybe textbooks and things such as that. But I know a lot of people are interested in television series. You've got the Walking Dead. You've got the other series on TVs that people are watching, and I'm hoping
Tom, you can look at, but like I said, the technology is changing. Both me and Michael, both of our works are in the top 100 of Audible right now, and it's a significant number. You know, it's changing. People still want the stories. People are reading them on Kindle. They're doing what's called a whisper sync, where they can read along with the Audible. The technology is changing. It's not dying. It's just growing.
I don't particularly see a tremendous difference between the two. I mean, they talked about the fact that the narrative concept is dying, but that's ridiculous. Movies are narrative, so are modern-day computer games, so are TV shows and plays. I don't see the difference. I mean, because you have someone speaking the words of the characters, how is that different from a novel, essentially? Instead of actually describing the setting, you can see it. I mean, someone wrote that, and that could have been a novelist who's now doing a screenplay. I mean, I don't see that there's a difference between one or the other, and I don't even know why this would be even an argument, because there's certainly no such thing as the story going away, because you have TV games and movies and plays, and these things are just as popular as ever before.
Well, my son learned, you know, my son learned to read, man. I mean, really learned to read through Japanese anime. He loved the anime, and he got the ones on Hulu were in Japanese and had subtitles. And somebody had to write that. You're absolutely right, man. You know.
Yep. Okay, let's go to the chat room. Is there nothing there? Okay, everybody's just kind of sitting back watching and listening. We have a number of people that are listening to the show. I can look and see that. You guys are generating.
Actually, I have a question for Michael. When did you feel you really arrived as a novelist?
Okay, actually, that was when I was at a convention, and a fellow by the name of Mike Cole, who's an author in his own right, he does a wonderful military science fiction story, and he walked up to me, and he knew me, and he said, "Oh, my God, Michael Faye Sullivan, I just want to shake your hand, and I was wondering if, you know, I think so great of you," and he brought some people over and introduced them to me, and I'm like, that's the first time that's ever happened. And then I had this was at Balticon, and I had a friend. I had a fan stop me. He was just walking down the hallway, and he stopped me, looked at me, and he goes, "Are you Michael J. Sullivan?" I said, "Yes." And he reached out, and I took his hand. We shook hands, and his hand was quivering. And I was like, "Wow,
that is amazing."
Crazy. Yeah, I thought that was nuts. And I went back and told my wife, I'm like, "You wouldn't believe what just happened to me." And
have you ever been starstruck by another author?
Me?
Have you ever been starstruck?
I've never really met any other authors until, and most of the authors I meet, I just barely know. I haven't met any of the names that, you know, I haven't met like Martin or anything like that. I haven't really had an opportunity to be starstruck. I don't get starstruck too easily by anyone. I think the only person I ever really met that I knew was like Alan Alda.
Who would you like to meet out of, especially in our genre? Who would you like to meet?
Oh, the person I probably liked to meet was Brandon Sanderson, and I did actually meet him. I did a panel with him, so that was kind of fun.
Yeah, anybody can finish off the Jordan series, you know. If I'd never read anything else he had written, which I have, but I would be a fan right there. Just the perfect guy to finish that series. Oh, my God, you know?
Yeah.
We got about 13 minutes left here, folks, and it's probably your last time to give us a call, so don't be shy. 626-213-5613 and toll-free 877-878-1436. And I do have a question for both of you, and we've asked this question on all of our shows. If you could meet somebody famous, who would it be? And if you were in a room with them all alone and you walked into the room, what would be the first question that you would ask them? Michael, let's go with you.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm the bad person to ask that because I really have no answer. I have no idea. I've never really been all that kind of an idol keeper. I mean, there are certain people. Almost everyone who I'd be interested in meeting are all dead.
Okay. Well, no, you can talk to them too.
I mean, Tolkien, who's the one who started me on my journey here, and C.S. Lewis, both of them, I was huge fans of. And of course, I suppose the other person who is still alive would be Stephen King, because I was also a huge fan of his as well.
What would be the first question you would ask him?
Oh, wow. I guess maybe how he came up with the idea for you know, going from what used to be fantasy to what how he got from, you know, George MacDonald's kind of more archaic writing to bring it into a modern day, you know, appeal. I'm not sure.
Brian?
Do I get the time travel?
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to answer it the same way I answered it last time you asked me this. I could be at the Eagle and Child's, and while Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and all these guys were reading each other's stories to one another, and I wouldn't say a word.
Very good.
I would want to know what they were drinking.
Yeah, right?
That's good. Okay, it looks like we have a caller on the line here. Nope, they're gone. Come on back.
Well, I have a question, if I can ask one of Brian here.
Sure.
I was wondering about your audio. Did you go through a publisher, or did you do that by yourself?
Yes.
Did you go through ACX, or how did you get that done?
No, actually, audio publishing company, Podium Publishing.
Oh,
they've
okay.
done the. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No,
but they published The Martian, you know, but you know, Weir wrote that. They came to me shortly after they. Are you familiar with Ben Hale?
No.
He's another indie fantasy guy. And he, they had done his books, and they had done very well. And they came, they approached me, and asked me if I'd be interested. And I had never even considered doing an audiobook. So I was like, you know, I owned my audio rights, so I'm like, you know, why not? You know, I wasn't going to do it, so why not? You know, so it would be, even if it, you know, even if it only made me $1, it was $1 I wasn't going to make. You know. And I didn't have to do anything. They took care. They took care of everything. You know, they you know, hired a brilliant narrator named Derek Perkins. He just did such an amazing job, and it just sort of took off. I mean, it was kind of reminiscent of how my Kindle books did when I first started. You know, back in 2012, and. They were, you know, and then they did that big, and I did it just, and it just happened just at the right time, because remember they did that first in a series sale.
Mm-hmm.
And, it, oh my, and then, you know, sold a ton of books then. It's just been an amazing experience. Like I said, they came to me, and out of the blue, and I did a little research on them, made sure they were, you know, who they were, and just sort of went from there, and I'm going to be... as soon as I finish book six, I'm going to be sending it off to them, and you're going to have the whole series out. And they actually, it's done so well that they're going to have them burnt to CD. They've already approached the distributors, and the distributors are very interested. But they want to wait till the entire series is out, then it's going to be burnt to CD and sold to bookstores and libraries and stuff.
That's great. Yeah, I was wondering, because if you were through ACX, they were running, I think, 40 to 90% royalty, which you would be, like, really rich by now.
Yeah, right? But I also wouldn't have had the advertising and the things that they did for me, you know. Yeah, right. I've seen a bunch of other indie authors that pretty much sell on the same level as I do, but my audio books do a lot better than theirs, and I attribute it to what they do, so...
Okay.
Cool. For back for the third time here is Eminent Astrology. And do you have a question or comment for
nope.
Michael Ryan?
No, can you just put me on mute? I'm just listening to the rest of the show, that's all.
Oh,
thanks.
Okay. Well, we'll put you on mute. There we go. It's good that she's called in because she's adorable. I like her. I like the questions she has. And I would invite her back to listen to our other shows here on the Writer's Lounge. A little promotion here. We do a show every other Monday at 7 p.m. Central Time. And we have a variety of authors on. And we're going to be doing a show in another 2 weeks. And we're going to have Dave Moore on and his book called Lines in the Wall. Did I screw that up, Dave?
You should have said Dave Moore Dave with Moron. Us because
yes.
It sounded like you said Dave Moron.
And I did, and I did when I heard that. I hope he wasn't listening to that. So, but I want to thank everybody once again. Over the course of the last 2.5 years, the Writer's Lounge has had tremendous success, and I owe it to guys like Michael and also Brian, of course, who has been my co-host here several times. And we are really doing well. So I want to remind everybody, if you do have a book, make sure you send it during our next session. Right now our session is closed up through July, but we will open up in August for another session of 4 months. And send your books to pwl11@yahoo.com and wait for the opening. I'll let everybody know. And and so we're winding down here, and I'm just wondering if Michael and Brian would give us information on where they can find you guys on the Internet, and also any closing comments that you would like to make to our listeners out there, both advice and anything else that you would like to say to them. Michael?
Well, you can find me at Ryera.com, and I'll spell that so that anyone can figure it out. It's R-I-Y-R-I-A and www.ryira.com. It should be easy to pretty much find any information you need about me. As far as advice, pretty much the only one that really works, which is actually what Brian's going to say anyway, I'm going to anticipate him, which is you can only fail if you give up. So if you don't ever give up, you're probably never going to fail. So his persistence is mine as well. I mean, I did it I actually worked for 20 years, and I wrote, 10 novels, I think, over a 10-year period and never got anywhere. But it took me many, many years, but finally I actually had to give up before I actually became successful. But don't give up. Eventually those years that you spend working and failing, they end up becoming what you went through to get where you're going. It doesn't seem that way when you're doing it, but afterwards you can look back and go, oh, yeah, it meant something. But before that, you think to yourself, no, it was terrible. But and you think you're never going to get anywhere. But when you do, those are the years that made you who you are.
Very good. Michael, it's been a pleasure, and I'm going to have to read some of your material, and I'll do some reviews on your books. Thank you so much for being at Writer's Lounge.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Bye, Michael.
Bye-bye.
And, okay, Brian, that leaves you, my friend. Where can we find you on the Internet, and what are your closing comments?
Author, you can find me on authorbriandanderson.com. You can also find me on my blog spot, same thing, except I think it's like /blog.com or what. And you can find me on Facebook. Just type in The Goblin Chronicles or Author Brian D. Anderson. You can Google it, and I'm just all over the place. You know, as far as Michael hit it on the head, you just can't give up. You got to believe in yourself. You know, you just got to believe. You know, don't listen to the naysayers. Don't listen to the people that are telling you can't do it. You know, don't let them make you feel like you're destined for failure, because you're not. You know, I mean, even if you write a book and it doesn't sell, but you know what you did? You wrote a book. You know, how many people get to say that? How many people are out there saying, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that? You know what? Once you've written a book, and whether it ever sells a single copy, you did something that 99% of the people in this world swear to God one day they're going to do.
Very good. Very good, Brian, and we will catch you around, my friend, and thank you for being on the Writer's Lounge. Also, of course, I want to mention Hugh Howey, who had to leave early. Look him up. All you need to do is do a search engine on him. Brian, good night to you, my friend, and we'll talk to you again.
Good night. Take care, Tom.
Okay, and that leads us to the end of the program today, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with Dave Moore. With lions and all. I'm looking at Lisa here, and I want to thank Lisa, too, for remaining the chat room, or womaning the chat room, I guess it would be. And once again, at the Writer's Lounge, what does that say? Let the story begin, and we'll see you next time. Bye now.
In the middle of the day, your faith and your fences have been blown away. You're down in the cellar and you've locked yourself in. Ah, but it looks like it's rainbow weather again. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. Storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out wind, and it looks like it's rainbow weather again. God spoke to Noah one beautiful morn. He said, Noah, get ready, for the sky will be torn. Build as I tell you, save what you can. Then wait while the rainbow weather begins. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. Storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out on a westerly wind. And it looks like it's rainbow weather again. Trouble will come, but trouble will go. You're living in fear, but what do you know? You know that the sun's always coming then. You know there'll be rainbow weather again. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. The storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out. Like it's rainbow weather. Yeah, it looks like it's rainbow weather again. The storm clouds apart and the sun peeking. The rain will roll out on a westerly wind. And it looks like it's rainbow weather.